Good afternoon, good evening, good morning for some. Thanks for joining. This webinar will be recorded and will be available for review on our website following today's discussion. Today's topic is A Bridge Over Troubled Waters, the Future of Transatlantic Climate Cooperation Under President Biden. The goal of today's discussion hopes to offer up insight into the EU-US climate partnership. I think it's fitting before we get into the policy that I say thank you to those who made today's event possible. Thank you to the Brussels team, of course, Katharina, Katrina, Tim, Nancy, and Deborah for your hard work. Thank you to the audience for taking time during these crazy times to spend 50 minutes with us. That is important. And then most importantly, thank you to our honored guests who have decided to join us today. I will give some very brief introductions and bio materials of our guests, but I would ask of them, before they speak, to share something that isn't on their bio that the audience may be unaware of, and then who inspired you to get involved into the climate discussion. Our first guest, Connie Hildegard, is the chair of the OEDC Roundtable on Sustainable Development and is a former European Commissioner for Climate Action. John Podesta is the founder of the Center for American Progress and former counselor to President Obama on climate policy. And then most importantly, a former chief of staff to President Clinton, whom I had the honor of serving with John. I can say this unequivocally, that President Clinton knew policy better than anyone, and there was only a few people that I saw firsthand walk into the Oval Office and went toe-to-toe with the president on policy, and that was John. He's one smart guy, and I'm happy that he's with us today. And then lastly, and most importantly, Monica Arsoni, who is a friend, a senior advisor at Teneo, and a former co-president of the European Green Party. So before we get into the questions, I do want to brag on my home state of Wisconsin. In that Senator Gaylord Nelson in 1969 proposed a national teach-in to send a message to Washington, D.C. that public opinion was solid behind a bold political agenda on environmental problems. He hired some of the best organizers in the country, and then a year later in 1970, on April 22nd, the first Earth Day was observed across the U.S. 51 years later, nearly 200 countries from around the world celebrate Earth Day. And I think, it's always important to give credit to those who stood before us, particularly who made today possible. So moving into the Q&A and question, Connie, do you want to share a little bit about yourself that isn't on your bio and how you got drawn into the climate discussion?
Well, I can do that. Awesome. Thank you very much. I think before I became a minister in Denmark for environment in 2004, I was sort of anchoring a late night magazine at the Danish TV broadcasting. We normally said that for us to go into climate back then, it should be a day where so many other pieces could not come together. And then on my first day in the office, I was called in from outside to become a minister. And the first question I got from the employees there was, what do you intend to do with the climate? And you can imagine being a journalist the one day and then next day having to answer that question. That was quite a tough one. And I normally say that was when my climate education started, because since then, the more you know about this challenge, the more you also feel inclined to actually do something about it.
That's great. And thank you for sharing that. Moving into the questions, my grandmother used to say, we don't grow when things are easy. We grow when things we face are challenging. And I think it's fair to say the last 4 to 5 years on the issue of climate, the US-EU relations have been a bit of a challenge. I guess my first question, if you could speak to, is now that the US has moved into the international discussion on climate change and particularly re-signing the Paris Accord, what do you see in the future, and what do you see as potential obstacles?
Well, Orson, first I would say that to see what has happened during the first 3 months of the Biden administration, and I know there are many obstacles and challenges ahead, but that has been fantastic seen from a European perspective. So, I mean, the first sort of thing is that we sort of see it with joy and expectation, a lot of hope. And I also think it's fair to say that many of us sort of drawn a sigh of relief. And why is that? Of course, it means a lot also geostrategically. When the US administration is engaged in international climate politics, but I would also say that seen from a European perspective, to continue our ambitious climate policies and reaching out to our, reach our ambitious climate targets without US on board. I mean, had we had four more years like the previous four years, I would really have feared that we could not keep together the very strong support across partisan lines in Europe with business, with investors. We would have seen more polarization, whereas I think there is new hope now as the US is engaged as much as we have seen. I think it's fantastic that we have seen the China-US statement last weekend. We saw John Kerry's visit to Brussels. We have heard new things being said about both shipping and other areas. Many good things happening potentially in the United States. It's incredibly important. And just to share one positive news with you, this morning at 5 a.m., I understand, the 27 member states of Europe, the European Parliament and the Commission agreed, all of them, to the at least 55% CO2 reduction target by 2030, to enshrining that target in a climate law, to be guided by an independent European scientific advisory board, how to actually fulfill this, and also to elaborate now sectoral roadmap. So I think that it is as if now we dare move from sort of discussing the targets to entering into really delivering and implementing. And I think it means a lot that the US is playing ball there now.
That's great. Could you speak to outside of the US, what you think the discussions in the US will mean towards the EU-China climate collaboration?
But I mean, it means a lot. EU has already always tried to sort of continue to have a very a good dialogue with China on the climate topic, and also to a certain degree been successful in doing so. But I mean, we saw already back in 2014, when John Podesta had come to the White House under the Obama administration, and John Kerry and John Podesta and the whole team there, and of course the president himself, really engaged in the bilateral talks with China, ending up with the US-China agreement of November 2014. Then we all knew that the way had been paved for the Paris Agreement. And that is why I think that what is happening now with the US sort of coming on stage saying now, despite many of the challenges with China and the big also strategic discussions there in the climate field, it seems to have been accepted now internally in the Biden administration that climate should be an area where they really engage constructively with the Chinese. I think it's absolutely key. It also makes it easier for Europe to play Europe's cards and the EU, US, China together. That is incredibly important for keeping the momentum here. So I think that is important. I would also hope that that could then also lead to more activities, say, for instance, in the G7 and G20, which has been prohibited by the Trump administration for the last many years. I mean, there are areas where we could be very, very specifically cooperating together, like phasing out fossil fuel subsidies, like agreeing on the green financial taxonomy, like maybe an end date for the combustion engine. General Motors announced that recently. Volvo has done so. Other big players are on sort of just about to do this. And what about a concrete target for emission-free electricity? And finally, could we, for instance, cooperate on modernizing the WTO, who has, just as we all know, just gotten a new management? I mean, often we say that climate change must be compatible with WTO and international trade rules. Now it's time also to make the WTO compatible with the climate change challenges so that it promotes and not prevents climate action. So I think there are numerous rather specific areas where we could work together and where also our respective citizens could see that it makes sense that we are moving forward in the same direction.
That's great. Any additional points or things that you have observed that you think would be useful to share with the audience before I go to the next presenter?
No, I would just say that I think that big business and investors, they are really getting that. So what we will also see in the years to come is, as a side effect of this momentum, that will of course be increased competitiveness. So if I should say something, it's fantastic for seen from a climate perspective, but I also think that it really should make Europe look through its processes and procedures, because we need to be more flexible, a bit more agile in order to make faster innovation. Because I think that if we feel we have been sort of not alone, but we have been sort of leading this for some time, now we will have much more competition. That's good for climate, but it is a challenge to European business.
Well said. John, this week definitely will be a good week for the Biden administration. It's been said that its climate team is like the Fab Five or the greatest team assembled of all time. I heard comparisons to having Michael Jordan and John Kerry and others, you know, the dream team of sorts of climate. And they're off to a great start. And I saw the schedule and agenda today, which is truly remarkable. The only team member who is on the sideline, of course, is you, who has coached and mentored a lot of the folks who are at the table today. With that, you're an insider, you know, what can we expect from this leader summit, and what kind of outcome do you think with this dream team would be seen as a success? And before you answer that, if you could share something that people don't know that isn't on your bio, and then who inspired you to get involved in the climate discussion?
Thanks, Orson. I'll start with not on my bio. I grew up in an industrial part of the city of Chicago, and you know, very blue collar part of the city. It wasn't exactly the place where naturalists were made. You know, we were lucky to be kind of playing in the street. But I always sort of went from there to to wanting to be kind of out in nature. And then I went to work for President Clinton. And we, as you remember, I had an amazing rate of success, and we're very ambitious in protecting the great places in America, like the North Rim of the Grand Canyon, and through creating other national monuments. And it really was, I think, that my avenue into climate was really seeing what the effects on the natural world were, and then what the effects on human security were, how much damage it was going to do, particularly to the poorest people around the world. So it was my, you know, kind of working with the president that got me into it. And then I have been into it, and that sort of spent the last couple of decades really with this as the focus of my work, including at the Center for American Progress. And yeah, I am on the sidelines, but I feel like I am doing my bit to create the conditions for success.
Yes.
Through the analytic work, through, we created a advocacy organization called Climate Power. So we're the outside brigades trying to make sure that the Congress moves along with the very aggressive proposal the president put on the table through the American Jobs Plan. I'll just say just a couple of things, which is, I think that, you know, beginning last summer, when the president really made this central to the crises facing the American people, the COVID crisis, of course, the economic crisis, the climate crisis, and the racial justice crisis, he wove together a narrative about how to build an economy that's more equitable, more just, that's going to work better for the American people. And climate was the heart and reaction to that, and transforming the energy system to one that was dirty to one that was clean was central to all of that. He made good on that promise. He, you mentioned the Dream Team, because I'm from Chicago. I want to know which one, Scottie Pippen. But he reorganized the White House structure. He put Gina McCarthy in charge of an all government effort. I think, surprised everybody by appointing Secretary Kerry, someone with real depth of knowledge on the topic, real passion for the issue, as special envoy, sitting on the National Security Council. So it became the heart of his diplomatic strategy. And now I think this summit kind of culminates in the promises he made in the campaign to move forward with a major investment package to put people to work, to recover from the COVID economic crisis, to create a cycle of innovation, of investment, and to make sure that he makes good on his other pledge, which is that 40% of those investments go to disadvantaged communities, go to the communities that have been heavily burdened by pollution from industrial sources, from pollution from fossil fuel power production and others. And I think he is aiming at really doing, and I want to pick up on one thing that Connie said, which is to look at each sector of the economy and come up with a pathway to essentially decarbonize, reinvent, and create a stronger, better, and fairer growth model from that. So he's taken what had been in the United States really a conversation about restraint and turned it into a conversation about opportunity. What is the economic opportunity that's available at every layer and sector of the society to change the way we're doing business, to create a cleaner platform right now and certainly for our kids and our for their future. So it's really exciting. I think in terms of what the outcome of the summit is, the United States will put its NDC, the nationally determined contribution, on the table. The New York Times reports this morning that it'll be 50%. I have reason to suspect they are right. I don't think the official announcement has quite happened yet, but it'll be probably, they may actually have a range, but I think the floor will be 50%, which is good. It's there was an analysis that came out at the earlier part of the week from the Rhodium Group that basically said it's because we're on slightly different baselines, it's sort of the equivalent of the EU 55% commitment. The UK is even a little bit stronger in terms of their decarbonization picture between now and 2030. I think there'll be some other announcements. Obviously, the President Xi has just announced that he will attend the summit and make a major speech. One of the things I think we've pressed upon our Chinese friends, and I've stayed in touch with them certainly during the course of this year, is that while the net zero by 2060 announcement that he made at the UN is welcome, they need to do better in the 2020s. They need to do better in terms of their own domestic economy, get that peak year up. They can do that. It's not that difficult. They're still building out coal. They can stop doing that. And they got to do better in terms of international finance through the Belt and Road Initiative. So I'm hopeful that maybe that President Xi will actually enhance what China can do in the next decade. But certainly others like Japan, South Korea are moving in the direction of more ambition.
That's great. Thank you for that. A question in that we have a lot of audience members from the corporate community joining today. And, you know, in celebration of Earth Day and the discussion topic, if you are a CEO of a major corporation, what would you be thinking about with this dream team in-house, and what items or strategies would you be pressing your team to proactively figure out ways to partner?
Well, look, I think that they have an open door policy. They're talking to the corporate world, trying to think about how to enhance the ambition in the private sector. And how the government actually can become a partner in enabling a more rapid transition. For example, I know they're in deep conversations with the automakers and with the United Auto Workers to do again what Connie suggested, which is to get to a point where they can through support for manufacturing and other enabling steps that they can take, they can move forward to get the particularly cars and light duty trucks to the point where new car sales are basically in the United States, I think they're going to be all electric, but zero emission vehicles sometime in the middle of the next decade. I think that 2035 is the GM announcement is consistent with that. I think you can see a pathway that begins to increase reduces emissions from the sector between now and 2030, but then moves towards an all electric platform by 2035. And certainly the investments in charging and in manufacturing support that the president's put forward to the Congress are aimed in that direction. But I think you just can go sector by sector. Think right. about that in chemicals, think about that in finance, think about that in retail. And I think what the administration wants is really a partnership with the private sector to get the, but they want ambition. They're not right. gonna give up on those goals that the president put forward in the campaign. And they wanna see how they can create a partnership to kind of align private investment to move in that direction.
And do you think there's a bipartisan honest discussion on moving some ambitious legislation this year before the midterms related
no.
to
No, I don't think so. I think there are a few, there are a few Republicans who will probably they're certainly trying to see whether that some of the infrastructure spending that they proposed that would move in this direction, whether they get some Republican support for it. And they, Republicans have supported, for example, the tax support for clean energy that, that the president's proposed. They've supported it in the past. There's no reason they couldn't support it. But we're living in a tribal world in Washington. And you asked an honest question. I gave you an honest answer, which is, I think the chances of getting a, and the, you know, this goes also to the question of U.S. credibility. It would be better, of course, if we could do what the EU just did, which is embody in law the and make clear that these commitments are put into place in law. But I think that the more likely path, at least in the short term, is that the investments that are included in the American Job Act can get passed. There might be a few Republican votes for it, but it probably gets passed through what people probably know something about on the call, which is budget reconciliation, which means a simple majority in the Senate can pass it, mostly with Democratic votes. And those investments will stick. You know, it's not like, you know, once you build out that charging infrastructure, somebody's going to tear it out if there's a new president someplace down the track. So I think we've got to do that. We've got to use the tools he has to increase standards. I think he wants to increase partnership. The U.S. Trade Representative, I think, is going to be quickly engaged with her European colleagues on things like carbon border adjustment. And you know, those, that momentum is there. It even stuck through Trump. Climate denier, but the progress stayed at the subnational level through states, through cities, through the private sector. So we just got to accelerate, move that momentum forward. And I think that Biden's package can do that, but I'm skeptical he'll have much help from Republicans, if for no other reason than he proposed it. we're in a period where there's a sort of it's kind of beyond tribalism, I think, at this point.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You mentioned the big Mo word, as in momentum. From an international perspective, you know, the EU and the U.S. need to bring that big Mo to the global agenda before the COP26 to get other countries to step up. How do you think, or do you think this weekend is a great way to create that momentum, or will there be other opportunities? Any thoughts on how to get the big Mo going before the big next summit?
Yeah, well, look, I think this began with the meeting that was held last December on the fifth anniversary of Paris. This is a point on the calendar that's important because these leaders are getting together, pushing each other towards greater ambition. That is the design of Paris, which was to do stock taking, to go further as we learn more about the science and the consequence of the science. So that's all good. But then the next is the G7, then the G20, then the Convention on Biodiversity, and finally Glasgow. And I think that the UK, Italy, support and programming for those next several meetings is well along. And I think the United States will want to participate as a good partner. You know, obviously this weekend, but then going, I think the next big date on the map is probably going to be the G7 in June.
Well, I hope everyone has witnessed why I said, whenever I walked into the Oval Office and saw John make a presentation, I walked out saying, that guy really knew his stuff. And that hasn't changed. And the same with Connie. Moving to our next presenter, Monica, my friend, one of the EU's most striking climate initiative is the implementation of the carbon border adjustment mechanism, which some critics will say that Biden has been quiet about support. A question, the EU agreement for 2030 target, what will it mean for EU policy? And on the flip, does this mechanism represent a test of renewed transatlantic climate partnership?
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Buon pomeriggio. I'm very glad, of course, to be here to share the panel with two so not only high level, but very prestigious panelists. And I am very interested in what they said and their insight. If I may also, I would like to say something in relation to the issue, not so much of the bio, but of the experience.
Yes.
Because what Connie said is exactly the contrary of what you would experience from where I come, which is that till every time you would talk about climate, the eyes of your interlocutor would go completely blank. And I think that that is also something that has changed in the European debate. It is no longer something that is limited to some people or some countries which are more advanced or more democratic, but it became really a global and European conversation. And this is certainly something that is positive under the under our point of view. Coming to your point, well, I actually think that the carbon border adjustment mechanism is really probably not the priority in this moment in the debate. First, because it is something that is not yet there. Actually, as far as the European Union is concerned, is a very important element of the conversation in the international arena, and also in trying to understand what the others will do. I have some suspicion that some of the more positive noises that come from China also come from a certain worry of this kind of mechanism coming through. But I would say that in this very moment, what the European Union is doing in a more concrete way is certainly, as Connie underlined, the climate law, the 15 legislation that are coming about with the so-called FIFA 55 package, and the taxonomy, that is to say the standard for green finance, green sustainable finance. And these are all issues that are not at all one, and are not all going in a completely right direction, but that make that there is a lot of necessity of a major mobilization of public opinion. And of course, COVID-19 didn't make it very easy for Friday for Future movement, and in general for public opinion to follow this in a very close way, as it was the case before, although there are many new ways of participation that are coming about, but also for business and for local authorities in general, for sub-state actors. And I really think that the three elements, the fact of having a European level area of decision making and of legislation, and also an international and global commitment that has to come about, will function, as far as Europe is concerned, as a major push to go into the right direction. And also, I believe that what happened when Mr. Biden arrived, and the fact that he appointed Mr. Kerry and decided for the meeting of tomorrow, also rushed the European Union, for example, to come out exactly today on taxonomy and on the agreement on climate, as well as the due diligence for business as far as sustainability is concerned. So I think that we could be in a rush for the best, in a positive competition. But I am also of the opinion that unless we have a major involvement of public opinion and civil society in general, and a global mobilization, a well-informed one that does not stop with slogan. For example, when you talk about the climate law, you see that some numbers really don't add up. That is not 55% but it is net 55% reduction, which already opens the way to some loopholes. And the same thing is with taxonomy. Perhaps nuclear and gas could come in. So not everything is bright, but I think that there is really a space at the European level in order to be really, let's say, abiding by their ambitions. But at the same time, without the global push, both of the United States and of public opinion and business, I am not sure that we are going to get there.
So do you think there's a possibility, though, with future summits, that the mechanism piece could be a main focal point?
Yes, I think that it could be. As Connie said, and I really very much agree with her, unless the European Union doesn't get its house in order, meaning it makes a real reform in the way in which some internal mechanism work, meaning if you need, in order to adopt, for example, this mechanism, the unanimity of the 27 member states, you will not get it, or at least you will get it, I don't know when. And I think that all this conversation as far as climate is concerned, very much to the need of the European Union to have a reform of the way in which it works, get rid of unanimity and give more powers to the European Parliament. And I see a parallel somehow with the United States, because also, as far as you are concerned and your system is concerned, the way in which the relation between Congress and Senate and the way in which the majorities are created do establish certain difficulties for this agenda to move forward. And I think that this need of reform is probably one of the things that we must both be aware, also because it is a democratic reform we are talking about.
In the global discussion, what would you say is the driving force to really bring that, as we were talking about, the big momentum to make change? What would it take for people to bite into the apple and do it exactly as you say? What do you think is missing in the discussion?
Well, I actually think, as I said earlier, that unless you have leaders that are able to say, to set the direction, but also the perception of a major need of mobilization of civil society, because they perceive that this is not simply a leader saying something great, but it's also something that they can own, that they can bring about. I am not sure that we can go very far, because leaders, as you said yourself, pass after 4 years or 5 years. And also, and they can change, as we saw with Mr. Trump. And also, I think that we do need business community. Business community is really key because of the political majorities that can change. But the economic trends are there to stay, and the investment decisions are made for a long time. And in this moment, the business community is somehow divided between those who really want to change and those who probably need to break a little bit. And so we have to talk with both categories of business.
Thank you, Monica. I want to encourage everyone on the moderator chat to type in any questions that they would like to present to our presenters. And while that is happening, Monica, Connie, John, is there anything that was shared that you would like to ask each other that you would want to put forward now?
Well, I'm.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Sorry, John.
No, go ahead, Connie.
Okay, sorry. Just one point relating to what both Monica and John was mentioning about this sectoral pathways. Actually, in Denmark, in my country, where we have this, we have a 70% reduction target for 2030. So, a little more than a year ago, 13 different sectors were asked to sit together, agriculture, transportation, energy, consumption, aviation, shipping, waste, 13 sectors, to identify what in your sector would it take for whom to achieve this? What can you do yourself, all the key stakeholders in this sector? The top CEOs from Danish business were sort of presiding over each their sector. What can you do yourself? Where do you need some regulation or some framework conditions that are not there already? And where may there be some research and development still needed? And the interesting thing is they had 1 year for this exercise. They developed then their roadmap. And that has sort of created a huge buy-in from these whole sectors. And it has maybe also made the political discussion a little less focused on only the targets, but also on the hows. And there has been this tendency to work much more together, public and private sector together. And I think that is what we need. We need cooperation like we have never seen before, also between the private sector and in the public sector. And final point, I've seen something similar with the CEO of Volkswagen, Herbert Diess. He has initiated to convene the 10 CEOs of Europe's 10 big, very, very big companies to try to say, instead of sitting in each our silo coping with these things, should we start to sort of develop some of these new technologies across sort of normally company lines, normal sectoral lines, and normal border lines? Why don't we pool our forces to a degree that we have not done before? So there's something there that it challenges the climate change challenge the way we are capable of working together across sectors, internally in sectors, but also across the public and private sector together.
If I could jump in, I'll just make two points. It's kind of picking up on what Monica and Connie have said. One on finance. I think that's a place, again, in addition to trying to get the increased ambition through the diplomatic channel, one of the places that I think Secretary Kerry has really focused his energies is on trying to set the conditions for much more private sector finance to flow into the sustainability and clean energy space. And I would suspect there may even be some announcements about that in the next 2 days. But if you think about the challenge, I think the UN's best estimates, we're looking at $90 trillion worth of investments over the decade. That is a lot of mobilization of capital. And the conditions need to be there and available, and the willingness to kind of invest, backing out of that, the ability to understand what the climate risk is from not making those investments. There's a lot of work to be done across a large number of governmental entities as well as international collaboration. But I think we have got to make sure that we pay attention to that. One of the things that I think the developed world has fallen short on is that mobilization that Connie remembers well that came out of Copenhagen to do the $100 billion a year of mobilization. We can't even get to that. So think about getting to the scale of $90 trillion. That's really a critical enabling element. And the other thing I would just say on the, particularly through this sectoral discussion, and Biden embraced the notion of carbon border adjustment during the course of the campaign. I think the challenge is going to be the systems are different and how one works and collaborates to synchronize or harmonize different systems in a way that keeps a friendly atmosphere around tradable sectors is going to be important, but it needs to be done because if I am sure in the context of the Danish industry discussions, the Swedish industry discussions, the US and Canadian industry discussions, people aren't going to want to make the change necessary if they think coming behind them are going to be free riders living off a base that's not reducing its emissions. And so creating standards for clean products, creating the conditions for trade in a world where we have to move towards essentially net zero world by the middle of the century is going to require a good deal of collaboration, but particularly between the US and the EU on how to harmonize those different levels of policy systems.
And for the panelists, one question that came up related to that is, do you see the EU or the US using the issue of climate to forge a better partnership with China? It could be argued that people are now trying to find ways on the private sector side to use this as a competitive advantage. Do you see each country finding unique ways to use it as a competitive advantage for trade, et cetera, et cetera?
Urs wanted to agree very much with before coming to this question that I'm sure also my co-panelists would like to address. I very, very much agree with what Mr. Podesta said on the carbon border adjustment mechanism as an issue on which to cooperate. Because first of all, as I said earlier, it is not that in the European Union this thing is all settled. On the contrary, it's very complicated. And I'm sure that it will be much easier if this is taken as one element, not so much of negative competition, but of positive cooperation for having standards that are comparable and that are actually, I don't know if unique, but certainly understandable to each other. Because indeed, the mechanism is not done for itself. It is done mostly to motivate everybody to go the right way so that it doesn't cost more. And of course, we also need, as Europeans, as Connie knows much, much better than me, more money for the European budget. But I don't think that the carbon border adjustment mechanism has this as main objective. It's more to avoid what we as Greens often say that it doesn't really exist, which is a famous carbon leakage. But that's, of course, a completely different conversation. But I think that, yes, if it would be possible to have a common work on this, I think it would be very nice. I would also agree on the question of finance. And taxonomy is a very complicated thing to do. But I think under that point of view, we have to move in the same direction. And finally, on China, you see, I actually am a bit puzzled about this idea of using climate as a way to improve the relation with China. Of course, it's great because I believe that we have to cooperate, but I also must admit that climate is not something in itself. You know, so the question of democracy, human rights, etc., are also linked to the health, you know, of the relations that we have, and I believe that climate can be used as a way to improve indeed the relations, but also as a way to say that you can have a good climate governance and of course a healthy climate policy if you also have a stronger democracy. But of course this is another target. It's another issue. But I really think that we should not see climate in isolation with the rest of our security and governance challenges.
Well said, Connie.
Yeah, it's just to the question from the audience. It is definitely not. I mean, I've followed this discussion on some kind of border adjustment for many years in Europe. It is definitely not to get a competitive edge over anybody, but it's in order not to be punished for actually taking your climate responsibility. And that is the key. But I would say that it is absolutely imperative that the dialogue that John Podesta is referring to now with EU and US, that also includes other big trade partners, the dialogue, the communication, the outreach around this CBAM, Because if that just pops out of the blue as a proposal from the Commission this June, without really having done substantial outreach, it really has the potential to create a lot of suspicion and souring the whole atmosphere there. So how to do that is incredibly important. And I think this whole discussion, whether it should be an own resource for Europe's budget and things like that, in my view, that was not the smartest thing in the world, that that was sort of mixed into this discussion at this debate. We have to be extremely careful, or all the good momentum that we have been talking about, is there now the big chance there is now internationally that could end very abruptly?
And I would just say at the U.S.-China level, at the bilateral relationship level, we're probably in the worst place we've been since diplomatic relations were started across a whole range of issues: human rights, democratic rights, trade, technology, IP, the relationship, the security issues in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. The security, the bilateral relationship is fraught with difficulty. But I think it's important that Kerry and Xie Zhenhua had a meeting, that they issued a joint statement, that we keep talking. And I suspect it's going to be, you know, partly important to just exchange both technical and diplomatic ideas, as we have in the past, which will be crucial to create global cohesion. There'll be some pressure, I think, certainly, for example, on using public financing to build out more coal overseas, particularly through the BRI. But I think we're into a phase where there's also going to be some healthy competition to move to these new industries, new product designs, to try to think about what does zero carbon steel look like, zero carbon cement, zero carbon glass, zero carbon aluminum. There'll be some healthy competition, and that's a good thing. As long as there are standards in place and a fair dialogue to create a level playing field to compete, we should want that cycle of invention, innovation, build out that will be good for Europe, it'll be good for the US, and I suspect in the long run it'll be good for China.
One of the questions that just came through was related to that. Could there be an international common solution to carbon leakage that you could get a smaller group of countries, the G7, G20 countries, to have a conversation?
New Zealand, I think it's Chile, it is for sure, Norway. There is 7-8 countries who have started a cooperation along these lines. And, you know, it's not China and the US, but at least somebody has tried to sort of show the way how you could make sort of a system, how you work together on these things. So I think that there is a potential really to work around these things. Ideally, that could be a job for the WTO, but probably not going to happen anytime very soon.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So we are closing out on the hour here. As a final question to the team, if we were to host this webinar a year from now, do you think the current discussions, the topics, will be the same, or do you honestly think a year from now we'll see real change and progress? So with that, why don't we start with Connie?
I hope we will see, I mean, the stars are well aligned now. There is a chance that we could take some of the new steps forward. I really think so. And I think big business, and I think that in the investor community, they are really coming on board here. They are changing sort of business as usual. So we have an enormous potential. I would also then end up saying, if we then did meet, maybe not in 1 year, but 2 years from now, and had not really moved anywhere, my fear would be that then you would see polarization between generations and politically, and you know, that would be so much disappointment. So I think that now with the ambitious target sets, all the good sort of things that people say that they want to do, it's time to deliver, or at least parts of our citizens will become extremely, extremely frustrated with the system's ability to cope with the climate change challenge. But I'm hopeful. I think that we have a chance to move forward now.
John?
Well, I'm optimistic that we can have a good year and that the United States will get its act together and make the investments that we've been talking about. But most of this discussion has been talking about how change is likely to happen in the most advanced economies. And I think if we come back a year from now, we'll also have to be dealing with the fact that the people who contributed the least to this problem are going to get clobbered the hardest. And what a sustainable development path is for the poorest countries in the world that are likely to suffer the consequences of climate is going to rise back up to the top of the agenda, because the threat to human security is enormous. You know, Europe experienced the immigration crisis during the course of the last decade. We're experiencing that on our southern border. That's only going to get worse. So we got to figure that out. And I think we're really at the early stages of that.
Monica?
Yes, I fully agree with what Connie and Mr. Podesta said, but I also would like to add that in a year from now, even if things go really well, in any case, we will anyway face a very complicated and different and difficult situation. And I think the state of the global climate that was just issued demonstrate that all the indicators are not going particularly well. So I think that we are set for the next few years in fighting very much for the trends to go in the right direction. And for the moment, they are half and half. So I think that it will be years of hard fight. And we don't know if we will win it, but we have to keep optimistic.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank our prestigious panelists for joining us today. I want to thank the Teneo Brussels team for organizing. And again, most importantly, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. Look for a robust discussion again in May on China-EU relations. And until then, this broadcast has been recorded. Feel free to visit the Teneo website to pull up. Do enjoy your day. And I, again, appreciate the opportunity to spend this time with you.
Thanks, Orson.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Good to see you guys. Good to see you, Connie.
Thank you.
Good to see you.